From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West.
I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Dustin Lance Black is joining us. Black won an Academy Award for writing the film Milk. He was one of the writers of the HBO series Big Love. He's gay, grew up Mormon, says he wants to use the lessons about getting along with his conservative LDS mom to heal the ugly divide that has afflicted the country. Black is coming to Utah this week, so we're talking with him about his new memoir called Mama's Boy. We'll be right back.
KUER is growing, with new reporters set to join our newsroom this year. We want to know, what issues should we be covering where you live? How can we better represent your community? What stories need to be told? Help us improve our service around Utah by answering a few short questions. Go to KUER.org and click Community Feedback Form under the About tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a story Dustin Lance Black tells in his new memoir about coming to Salt Lake City a few years ago and walking into the Joseph Smith Memorial Building. Now, I should explain, Black is gay. He's a successful screenwriter. He got an Academy Award for writing the film Milk. He co-wrote and created the HBO series Big Love. He grew up Mormon in Texas in a military family, and as he explains, because his church rejected him, he rejected it back. He left the faith years ago, and he was a vocal critic of the church's role in the fight against same-sex marriage. But when he walked into the Joseph Smith Memorial Building, he had been invited to come. We'll talk about that a little bit later. When he walked in, despite all he had been through, despite the fact the church still hasn't fully accepted LGBTQ members, he says he felt a kind of warmth and a kind of familiarity. Even though there still was plenty to disagree about and plenty of landmines ahead, as he puts it, Black says he felt a little like it was a long overdue reunion. This idea of reconciliation is an important theme in his book, which is really more than a memoir. It's a book about his mom, Anne, and their relationship. She was Mormon for a time and always really conservative. But Black uses the lessons he learned with her as a way forward to bridge the deep political and social divide in this country. Dustin Lance Black is in Utah this week, and today in the program he's joining us to talk about his book. It's called Mama's Boy, A Story from Our Americas. We'll give you details about his visit as we go along. He joined us from NPR in Washington, and Black's story is really interesting, but he's waited to write a memoir because he says he wanted something with some purpose.
I didn't see any purpose in a, you know, pat on the back kind of book. That seemed quite dull to me. And those were the moments that people were asking me to write a book, either after the Supreme Court win or after the Academy Awards. And I don't know what I was waiting for. I guess I was just waiting to see if there ever came a time that any of my stories looked like they might collide with history. They might collide with current events. They might be able to be helpful in some way. That's the standard that I hold my screenwriting students to. They bring in these real stories, and I say, those are fascinating stories. What does that have to do with tomorrow? And if they can't answer that question, I send them back to find a new story. I don't think a biopic or a memoir should be about nostalgia. If you're going to put that much work in, see if you can shake things up in a good way so that you can create some sort of positive change, at least in your opinion. And for me, I always knew that I had a somewhat extraordinary relationship with my mother.
Yeah.
My mother could not walk. She had polio when she was two. So a single paralyzed woman raising a two-year-old, a six-year-old, a 10-year-old, and thus we were raising her in return in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I realized I was gay and came to understand how that was in opposition to my devout Mormon military Southern family and their conservative leanings, I also understood that that was quite unique. I was an outsider within a very close home. And we had to find the bridges.
Yeah.
There was no choice but to find the bridges in my home. I had to figure out a way to maintain an intimate and loving relationship with my mother, even though I knew she was voting for people and supporting people and praying to a God that did not approve of me. But there was no choice. And we continued in that tradition for most of our lives. There was just one period that got very, very contentious that's in the book. But other than that, we always figured it out.
Yeah.
And she and I were both looking at this country and at our own family, and it was becoming clear that the divisions between members of a family and a community were becoming incredibly wide, and the heat of those arguments was becoming quite hot. And there was this narrative being sown by politicians, by 24-hour news shows just trying to sell insurance, I guess, that politics was the highest plane of existence, the best way to define oneself, and that we ought to stay in our own camps. And I just found that infuriating. And I did not like what that was doing to my family, my community, and certainly not my country. So for the first time, I thought that perhaps our little intimate American family story might serve a purpose.
Yeah. So this is the tomorrow that you're thinking about. And it's interesting. It's not just about gay rights, which you've battled for forever. It's not just about marriage equality.
No.
The thing that drives you now for this story is, how do I find this bridge?
Yes.
And how do we all find this bridge? That's the thing.
This is not about gay rights. This isn't about making movies. Yeah. This isn't about the things I think people associate with me. This is about something quite different. This is that I believe we have an American family. Now that I live outside of the country mostly, that's become quite clear that we are a very unique people as Americans, that we are a family, that we do have our own way of being and our own ideals. And it's quite tragic to me how divided we've become. And the heat of those divisions scares me, because as a student of history, I know how dangerous that can become. And I do not want to see my American family go through those incredibly painful, difficult, and deadly times again. And so I think those like my mom, who always showed the courage and the curiosity to reach out and to try and build a bridge with people who saw things differently than she did, it's time to do that work within the home and in communities and in our country to bring folks together. It's not an easy task, but it needs to be done right now.
Yeah. I want to dig into some of the stories in the book. I want to start with the prologue, which I found really interesting. This is the summer of 1987 you write about. It's your first time encountering Los Angeles. You are 13 years old, you and your family, which amounted at the time to you and your little brother and your mom and the smelly cat. And you're on the move. You're on the run, basically, on your way somewhere else. And you pass through Los Angeles. And it was just an interesting way to begin this story, because you mentioned feeling like the city in some way was calling to you. And this is long before you had come out to your mother or anything like that. Why begin with that image? I liked this.
I mean, this was a memory that lived in my mind for some time, because I think it's when the opposing forces, the opposing narratives, the opposing drives in my life first crossed paths physically. So I was a conservative, Southern, devout Mormon, son of a military family. I identified with those values. I loved my church. I admired the men and women I had met in the military. And certainly I loved the South. I loved Texas. I loved my family in Arkansas. Yeah. I loved our trips to Louisiana. But here we were driving through this place that I had always been told was damned and evil. Yet it was the home of the place that made movies and television shows, this other thing that I had very secretly and privately fallen in love with.
Yeah.
This place, it had been reported gay people lived here, sadly, mostly because of the stories around AIDS at the time.
Yeah.
But all of the sudden, this Southern red kid from the Mormon church is crossing paths with this other great, very progressive blue area. And it was the first time, I guess, I ever realized I was equally curious and enchanted with both sides of these things. with left and right, with blue and red.
They started to come together, those two.
Yeah, and that was, you know, then of course I start to have to examine all the contradictions and how difficult it is to have a foot in both of these worlds. It was very difficult. And today it seems that it's outlawed.
Yeah.
You're not even supposed to show curiosity in the other side.
Yeah. Let me back up to your grandma, Cokie. And it's I have to say, it's sad you never got to meet her, but she sounds terrific. And this is the way that you kind of begin to tell the story of the family and the deep connection to family and the deep connection to the South. Tell us a little bit about Cokie, because she sounds, I have to say, terrific.
Well, I feel like I did meet her. Huh. I feel like I knew her. And that's partly because of, I guess, a Southern tradition, but mostly a Mormon tradition within our family. My mom did our genealogy. Hmm. She kept journals. She told stories about my grandmother, and with such detail and color that I felt like I knew her, even growing up, and loved her. I mean, my son will never get to meet his grandmother.
Yeah.
But he'll get to read this book.
Right.
And there's at least a part of this book that I consider a bit of my old faith, my old Mormon faith's tradition to keep a record and to do my genealogy. I'll pass it along to him so he can get to know her.
Yeah.
The way I got to know Cokie.
Yeah.
Cokie was tough. Cokie did not believe in the impossible.
Right.
She was living on the south side of the river in Lake Providence, Louisiana. Now, on the north side of the river is where all the landowners, mostly white folks, lived, the wealthy folks. South of the river, where most people in Lake Providence lived, was incredibly poor. Tenant farms, tenant farmers, almost entirely black, except for Cokie.
Yeah.
And her 7 and then soon 9 kids she was raising on her own, working at a convenience store with her glasses that had little diamonds, she would say, in the corners, which were really just, you know, little bits of glass, I'm sure. And she worked her tail off to be able to raise these kids. And she dreamed that they would have better lives than she had. And she did all she could to make that true, even for her most challenged daughter, my mom.
Yeah.
Who at 2 years old stopped being able to move her legs because of polio.
For the longest time, it's interesting, Cokie thought your mom would walk. She told herself that. She told other people that. Even though her husband was sort of desperate alcoholic, had always said there's no way she's going to be able. And she didn't want it to be true. And then this, you tell the story of how the reality comes as kind of a shock to her. Do you mind telling that part of the story? And because I think this is a moment where Cokie tells your mom never to apologize for who she is, which seems really important in the story of the family.
It was a rare trip home from Warm Springs, Georgia, where she was, thanks to the March of Dimes, able to be and stay and have some sort of therapy and care. And at one point, when my grandma was doing stretching exercises up on the dining room table with my mom had a secret to share, a big surprise. And she said, "Look at my toes." And Cokie looked at her toes and said, "Yeah, okay, what am I looking at?" She said, no, really, look closely. And my mom's, one of the middle toes, was wiggling. And my mom was so proud that through all of that work, over all of those years, she could wiggle one toe. And Cokie began to cry. And it didn't take long for my good Southern mom, who can interpret tears, let me tell you, to understand those were tears of grief and mourning. That it was clear in that moment that after a decade of care, if all that had been regained was one wiggling toe, my mom was never going to walk. And then my mom began to cry in pain and shame. And my grandma Cokie, let me tell you, she moved that bar of expectations right then and there. And she said to my mom, "No way, no how. I am so damn proud of you for wiggling that toe and the work you did." And the story goes that she invited every single neighbor and preacher she could to the house and showed them my mom's wiggling toe. And if they didn't celebrate it to her satisfaction, they got an earful from Cokie.
Right. It's so interesting to see how that attitude was then became embedded in your mother, and it seems like in some ways it's embedded in you now.
That's the inheritance.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my mom absolutely inherited that from her mother, and I inherited it from mine. It's partly why I know Koki so well. Koki is in my heart. Koki is a part of me. So, you know, it was certainly that belief that anything called impossible is just your new goal is mine now.
Dustin Lance Black, his book is called Mama's Boy. On Thursday night, he's going to be speaking in Salt Lake City as part of Equality Utah's Q-Talk series. There are a limited number of standing room tickets still available. The event also is going to be streamed live on Equality Utah's Facebook page. You can get all of those details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Dustin Lance Black. We're talking about his new memoir. Black, as you may know, is gay, grew up Mormon, says he wants to use the lessons about getting along with his conservative LDS mom to heal the ugly divide that has afflicted the country. His book is called Mama's Boy, A Story from Our Americas. He'll be in Utah this week. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later in the program. I don't know how much you connect being a writer to being part of the South where there's so many great writers. Like there's the story you tell of a family Christmas. This was before you, your mother and your grandmother, Koki, and she drops this treasured bowl, which wasn't just dropping a bowl. This was this big burgundy bowl. But you describe it as being the symbol of family's hope.
Yes.
And you talk about how the importance of family coming first in the South. I'm trying to decide how much of what you became as a writer was from the South, how much of it was Mormon. Well, I guess it's a melange of everything, right?
Let me tell you, two great traditions of storytelling come from the Mormon tradition of storytelling and the Southern tradition of storytelling. Now, one requires more hard liquor than the other. and thus, you know, the Southern stories tend to grow a bit more and people, you know, are mythologized much quicker. Really, by the first shovel of dirt on their grave, they become myths in the South. But I come from a family of great storytellers from the South, and we understood what symbols meant. But also when you're poor, like we were, I mean, Lake Providence is often still regarded as the poorest city in the United States of America. Mm-hmm. And you hold on to symbols. You need to find hope in small things and simple things. And certainly that burgundy bowl that each Christmas was filled with fruit salad. And let me tell you, fruit was an extravagance in a poor Southern home. That was stuff that came from a magical place called California. And my grandma Koki would chop it up, add a little bit of sugar, and let it chill in the refrigerator for the day. And yes, one Christmas, one very special Christmas, because my mom was allowed home, which was rare, Koki, not having told any of the family, had a heart condition, and her hands had begun to really shake and tremble. And that bowl was wet with dew from the refrigerator. And it slipped from her hands, and it shattered on the floor. And the way my aunts and uncles have described it is that there were these shards, these blood-red shards, all among the fruit, that was their hope. And it was a poetic story because it was the beginning of a very dark period in the family where lives were lost, and my mom nearly lost hers. And so it's, you know, I think poor folks and Southern folks and even Mormon folks know how to hold on to a symbol and to turn it into a story and let it frame their lives. And that's one that did. And I found that one to be true. It mm-hmm. held up. Let me tell you, there are others that haven't held up. There were plenty of stories of my little mom on her braces and her crutches.
Yeah.
Climbing the tallest mountain in Arkansas mm-hmm. faster than all of her cousins.
Yeah.
And that one, I'm not sure is true. But I loved it. I loved hearing it.
Yeah. How does the family make the transition? I mean, you're in the South, a place where, especially in the Bible Belt, Mormons are perceived with a good deal of suspicion. I think it's still the case. How is it your yeah. family makes this transition to Mormonism?
Well, my mom had a terrible experience with the Baptist Church.
Yeah.
The Baptist Church was the home of the March of Dimes effort in Lake Providence, Louisiana. And sadly, someone working for that church absconded with the money. Yeah. And that meant that my mom had to be taken from Warm Springs, Georgia, down to a hospital in New Orleans, which was tougher to get to for Cokie, for my grandma. Meant the twice-a-year trips turned into once a year, that she'd actually see her daughter, that my mom would see her mother. And it also meant that at this new hospital, they didn't believe in warm baths and stretching. Mm-hmm. They believed in the scalpel. And my mom would be wheeled away in the mornings without warning, have a rag put over her face, told to inhale the terrible fumes, and she would wake up hours later with new stitches running the length of her legs and arms and back, as they tried to replace muscle and cut away dead muscle and fuse bones. And eventually she almost died in a surgery yeah. that implanted two steel bars all the way down the length of her twisting spine. This is what happened because someone at her Baptist church was dishonest. And so she never felt good about it. She also didn't love all of the preaching about hellfire.
Yeah.
She didn't like that. She felt like she'd experienced enough hell in this life already. And so when she was fortunate enough to survive and go off to university, one of the first in her family to ever do so, when those cute, polished, well-pressed shirts and slacks Mormon boys showed up at her door knocking, she sensed salvation. This was the neat, tidy existence she had always dreamed of. And when they told the young woman, who had always been told she would never find love or a family, that she could have an eternal family and a perfect body in heaven, bingo. My mom was in, and she was fully in. She was devout. She loved the Mormon church. And she got a lot of grief from her siblings.
Yeah.
But she was a true believer. And then when a rather naughty missionary, not her own, but another,
yeah.
Asked her out on a date, which I don't think you're supposed to do on your mission.
No, you're not.
she said yes, and that man was my father.
Yeah. You mentioned how your Mormon congregation became for you not just your faith, but this was your community. It was your second family, and your hope is how you describe it. Explain that, will you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is why in my LGBTQ work, and I think some find it surprising, mm-hmm. I always make the case that it's unchristian to exclude LGBTQ people. Because in so many areas, I'm certain in Utah, but throughout the South, the church isn't just a place of faith. The church is also the center of the community. It's there to support you. It's there when you're in need. It's also sometimes the center of business opportunities mm-hmm. and how you might thrive and grow as a family. And so to exclude someone from faith in many areas in this country, certainly in Utah and throughout the South, it's to exclude them from protection and safety and a future. And so all of those things were very important to us. We were, for the most part, three little boys, rowdy boys, being raised by a paralyzed woman. And she was not always, you know, in the best state.
Yeah.
She sometimes really suffered. She was mourning the loss of her mother and the abandonment of my father, who vanished
right.
when I was 6 years old, took off, and raising us kids. And I think there was probably a potential that a foster care system might come in and say, this is just isn't workable. But instead, the Mormon Church stepped up and started putting little envelopes filled with cash in our mailbox. No names, no addresses, no, not taking any credit for it. And because of that, I get tearful thinking about it. Because of that, we got to stay with our mother. My mother got to raise us. And we had Christmas presents under the tree. And in that way, I will always be so grateful for the Mormon Church. And that makes the heartbreak of my exclusion years later all the more painful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, and we'll get back to this, but when you come to Salt Lake City, later in the book you talk about feeling this sense of reunion and warmth, which I think some people will find surprising given the rejection that you felt. But we'll come back to that. Let me ask
okay.
you, I want to ask you about this moment that you you have. It was kind of a big deal because I think you were in Texas at the time, and the church has managed to secure a satellite broadcast of the Mormon president at the time, Spencer
yeah.
W. Kimball, right? It's a speech,
yes.
and it's a big deal. You know, they're going to see
big deal.
Yeah. And what Kimball says in his speech, he said, next to the sin of murder comes the sin of physical impurity. And as you lay it out on the page, homosexuality. And it was the first time you had heard the word or encountered the word, I think, and you thought
yeah.
it was a tribe.
Well, yeah. I mean, it sounded fantastic. Homosexuality. Whoa, what is that? And he also, and he compared them to murderers, I believe,
yeah.
If memory serves.
Right.
And so I thought, and you know, I was already really curious about words, fascinated by story. I loved story. And the Mormon faith has some great stories and those paintings in the inside the Book of Mormon of, you know, muscly men
yeah,
with gold
yeah.
bracelets crossing the ocean. I mean, come now. I was taken. And so and we learned that I was learning early on that people exist in tribes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You have all of these different tribes. And so, and I was a student of the faith early on, and my mom was a devout believer. So I thought, well, this has got to be just another tribe. It's another one of these kind of, you know, very intricate names. And so I thought that's what it was until I said it one Sunday, I believe.
Yeah.
And I was very quickly rushed over to, or he came to us, this sort of salt and pepper haired man, very kind man from the church, whose kids I would play with, and he told me in no uncertain terms what homosexuality meant. I was 6 years old,
yeah.
And you know, I think for a second I found it quite fascinating. I just had no idea that people would lay on any people, as it was described to me,
right? Right.
Much less boys laying on boys. But I thought, boy, that sounds about right to me. I've often been drawn to those boys in those
yeah.
great Mormon paintings of, with all those muscles and gold dangling off of them. That's fantastic. Until he told me the repercussions.
Yeah,
and that wasn't so good. You know, the idea of not being able to go to heaven with my family, of bringing shame to them in this life. It was terrifying. My mom was all I had. I was being told if this thing that I already was starting to suspect was inherent in me would separate me from my family forever.
It's so interesting. You cop to two stories, which I think are interesting. One comes, I think, in 1982. A friend of yours, Tim.
Yes.
Comes out to you as Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
He tells you in a really sheepish way. Now, you're not that old at the time, so we'll give you a break. But you, as you describe it in the book, you went full missionary
yeah,
on him.
I did.
Tell the story.
Well, I believed that we were all little missionaries. And I think I was maybe 8, 9, 10, I don't know, somewhere in there. And at this point, I had already gotten in the habit of giving my homeroom teacher a Book of Mormon. I mean, as a Mormon, I was a real minority in Texas.
Yeah.
All right. There weren't a whole lot of us. And then because of how our Mormon church worked, I don't know if this is how they all worked, but we were pretty much at church 6 days a week and then family home evening on Monday. And so it's all I knew. I did not know what Jewish meant when he said it. I had no idea. I just knew it sounded really different. It didn't sound like the winning tribe, as I'd come to learn how things were built. And I thought, mostly I thought, he's going to be in real trouble. Like, that's, if he had told me he was Baptist, I might have just said, okay, well, I guess you'll be safe. But Jewish, whew. So I tried to convert him. And without understanding the harm I was causing and how prejudiced that was, but he did. He felt it. And his mom, who was inside watching as her son came out to me, and he had told me that his mom insisted he tell me. And she was not happy. And I never saw him again. I mean, in passing at school, but we never hung out again. And I do say in the book, it really wasn't for maybe another, you know, 6, 8 years before I would learn about World War II and about what happened to Jewish people and alongside them to gay people in concentration camps. And I say, perhaps if I knew more, if I knew better, I would have done better. If I knew that his people and mine had both suffered together, and that perhaps we could lock arms instead of trying to change one another, we might be stronger. I might have ended that day with my first ally instead of losing a friend because of my fear of difference. I was taught to be so afraid of difference.
You tell the story of this conversation you had with your mom. You'd gone back for Christmas, and you were packing up, getting ready to go, to leave. And you mentioned how you had had debates with your mom before. So it wasn't new for you to disagree about certain things, but she didn't know. And you weren't ready to come out to her this night, but she starts going on and on about the don't ask, don't tell part of the military, and she was outraged, as a good conservative would be, about Bill Clinton and his military policy that had come out. And so she goes off, and it comes out. I don't want to give too much away from the book, but do you want to say something about this moment?
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind. I didn't want to come out. I was afraid I'd lose her.
Yeah,
I didn't want to lose my mom. My mom was the most special person I'd had and will ever probably have in my life. And she's also an incredibly passionate arguer, debater, storyteller. And because I was saying nothing, she just went on and on and on. But I was out back in L.A. Yeah. I had gay friends now. And she wasn't talking about people in theory anymore. She was talking about me and about my friends. And I prayed. I remember sitting on the floor looking at her. She's on my bed. She has her crutches behind her. And I was praying not to cry, not to react, not to do anything. And I will never forget the feeling that of warmth as a tear betrayed me and started to roll down my cheek. And the room went silent.
Yeah.
And she looked me in the eye, and a good Southern mother can read tears like tea leaves. And she knew. In fact, I never had to say the word to my mom. And all I remember her asking was why. Yeah. Why I had chosen this. And I knew that that wasn't the case. This wasn't something I would choose. And I just looked up at her, gathered my courage, and then I really saw, maybe for the second time in my life, her braces on her legs, her withered, very thin legs inside them, and her crutches. And I just asked her in return, why did you choose those? And that's all I had to say.
Yeah. You know, I'm trying to imagine one of the things that really comes across in the scene as you write it in the book is that silence. There's part of it you say you don't even remember of that. And you sat there in silence for so long, you're not even sure how long you sat. And that's the thing that I remember the most, I think, from this moment as you tell it, is that silence. And it must have been dreadful at times.
Yeah, it's like a never-ending kind of burning feeling. And all the things that I wasn't ready to say and all the things I'm sure she just wasn't ready to say.
Yeah.
There was a lot of confusion. Mm. I mean, we had been told our entire lives, and I had even believed a lot of it from, you know, the state we were living in said I was a criminal. And still does, by the way. The church that we loved said I was, you know, damned for this, that this was evil. And medical professionals still in some parts of the country would have said you were mentally ill and subjected you to electroshock therapy or conversion therapy. I mean, it was a stacked deck coming from where I came from.
Yeah.
And so when that came to light, I was also scared. I didn't know what life held for me. I didn't know what future I might have. And I think that was later, my mom said that was her biggest concern. She still loved me, and she was scared, terrified for my future.
Let me fast forward. All the great stories related to you, of course, have played out. On the marriage equality front, you're having all of these victories. You've got the professional success, of course, that we don't even need to go over. Things are going really well, but you mentioned how, and your mother noticed this, you just seem to be getting sadder with each win. Talk a little bit about this, because you say that the victories, and this is interesting, left you with an empty space. Explain that.
Yeah, it was a really surprising feeling. I remember with each victory, whether it was, you know, even if it was an Academy Award, there was an empty feeling, like I wasn't quite connected in the way I needed to be connected to enjoy that. And in the fight for marriage equality, though it was going so tremendously well, faster and with better success than almost anyone, even in my movement, thought. But, you know, Proposition 8 was paid for in one way or another, mostly by Mormon money.
Yeah.
And those are my people.
Right.
And so much of my family in the South, in Texas, in Arkansas, well, boy, I hadn't really spoken to any of them in years. And I just started to realize that I had not shown some of the courage my mother had shown. And to back it up just a touch, after that terrible silence when she found out I was gay, my good conservative mom had the courage and curiosity to get on a plane and to fly to Los Angeles for my college graduation and to meet my gay and lesbian friends and to hear their stories and to get to know them. And in sharing personal stories, not the politics, not the science, not the law, but sharing personal stories with them, many of the misconceptions she held began to dissolve away. And she eventually would come to accept and love me for who I am. I hadn't done that courageous work. You know, I had not made the journey back to Texas to try and reconnect with my family. I was afraid of being rejected by them. Mm-hmm. I most certainly had never tried in any way to reconnect with the Mormon Church. I considered them the enemy for so long, particularly after Proposition 8. Right. And I realized that it might be something I ought to do to show the same courage and curiosity my mom did. And I know how much I appreciated that. I know how it healed our relationship. And I started to think, you know, I'm surrounded mostly with progressive folks, Hollywood folks, politically left folks, gay folks, who never think that we ought to reach out. we rarely think that we have a responsibility to build a bridge to the other side. And I've come to believe that that's wrong. It doesn't mean that the issues that we care about don't matter. What it does mean is we're going to hear some things we don't want to hear and we don't agree with. But if we don't show that courage and curiosity, something inside us breaks. As a person, as a family, a community, and a country, it breaks. And that's where we are right now.
Yeah.
And I urge people on both sides of this divide to meet with folks who have different political beliefs.
There's this great story you tell of you get in contact with Troy Williams. Those listening right now know who Troy is. I think they know his story. He's told it on our program before. And Troy invites you to come to Salt Lake and meet with LDS leaders. So I'll fast forward a little bit where he picks you up at the airport. And he takes you, I think you go right to the Joseph Smith Memorial Building. Say something. What was it like when you first stepped into the building? Because this surprised me, because you talk about how, you still had all of the issues there, and you still do in many ways, but there was a kind of warmth you say you felt, which is interesting.
I hadn't seen so much pastel in a very long time, I'll tell you that. it was like stepping into my childhood home again, and I did not expect to feel that. I knew I needed to do this. And I wanted to do this, but I didn't know how I'd feel about it. I thought it might be contentious. And really, from my first step into that building, I thought, this is, whatever spirituality is still in my soul, and there is a good bit, said, you're in the right place right now, buddy. You're doing the right thing right now. Doesn't mean I'm going to become Mormon again.
Yeah.
But something in me said, this is the tough work that we need to do. And by the way, it was quickly rewarded. The people I got to speak with there were probably also hesitant and wary. I mean, I hadn't exactly gone easy on the church in those years. I had made a show called Big Love.
Yeah.
I had done the voiceover and narration for 8, the Mormon Proposition, which held the church accountable for Prop 8. And yet there were these men who were willing to talk and willing to share stories. And I dedicated myself not to get into the politics, not to get into the facts and the science, but to do the actually more difficult and thoughtful work of trying to figure out the personal stories told from the heart that might illuminate the politics, that it might illuminate the science and the law. And in doing that, you know what you start to talk about? You start to talk about things like your family and about having kids and about what love means and community means. And guess what? Those are themes any Mormon can absolutely relate to. So by going to story to illuminate your point of view, you often find common ground with people you never expected to. And that's what happened there. And I know we are not going to agree in quick fashion on everything, not by a long shot. And I'm not going to change my views that LGBT people and our families must be treated equally. And I know they're not quick to change their views. But I think what we started to do was to see each other and to understand each other and to correct misconceptions. Some of them were so clear. There was a clear misconception that LGBT people want to deinstitutionalize marriage.
Yeah.
And very quickly, I think, because they could look me and Troy in the eye, and several others, by the way, as we talked about our desire to have family and what that meant to us, you know, that's the best lie detector on the planet is looking someone in the eye, and I think they could tell we were not interested in deinstitutionalization.
Yeah.
We just wanted to make sure our kids are safe, too.
Well, you tell this story about this conversation you have with this soft-spoken man who had been kind of your minder in the church building. He was leading you around and guiding you. And
I secretly think he was an apostle.
Really?
I don't know. He was...
Well, it seems like a lovely guy, and he's sort of timid in some ways, but he asks this really important question to you. He says, had you ever considered if you want a family. In other words, he's asking you, gosh, do you ever want to have kids? Tell that story, because this seems to really get to the heart of it.
Well, I think partly that was credit to Brandy Balkin from Equality Utah and Troy Williams and the folks that they had been introducing to the Mormon Church who had families. Mm-hmm. And so by doing that, there were new questions. And it's probably the work that they had already done prompted him to ask that question. And, I had to wholeheartedly say, you know, you didn't want me in the Mormon Church, but you can't exactly take the Mormon Church out of me. I mean, if I could have a dozen, I'd be thrilled.
Yeah.
It could have a soccer team.
Yeah.
I think I got a little emotional about that. Yeah. 'Cause at that point I thought maybe it was something, that I would never have, because, you know, it had taken many, many years, to get to the place where I accepted myself and then where I would actually even date. And then by the time we won marriage equality, I thought, I might be too old for all this. Who knows if I'll meet anybody? Mm. And so I jokingly asked him to say a prayer that I'd meet somebody great and could have kids with. And he just squeezed my hand. I don't think he knew what to say to that.
Yeah.
He was awfully sweet, but he was timid almost by design. And I really appreciated that. Mm-hmm. I think he was intentionally trying to be quiet and see where we could find compassion for one another. And,
yeah.
You know, I have to say, I learned a lot from that. There are times where we have to scream and yell and march, but I learned from that man that there's also times where being quiet and listening might help you further your cause more than you know.
Let me ask you about one more moment in the book. This is after your mother dies, and there's this part of you that feels like you hadn't fought enough for her. And it really stays with you for a while, and you're trying to find someone to lead a service for her, a memorial mm-hmm. service, like a funeral service, and you reach out to Bishop Gene Robinson. And he senses something in a conversation you have that there, this is how you put it in the book, that he sensed there was still, speaking of shards of glass from the thing you were mentioning before, he sensed there was still a shard of glass in you somewhere. Mm-hmm. So he flies out and you're having a conversation. I think it's the night before the memorial. And one of the things he asks is, what was it that she gave you? And what was it that you gave her?
Mm-hmm.
Tell this story, if you would, finally for us.
Well, I mean, not to ruin too much. the last thing my mother ever said to me was fight for my life.
Yeah.
That's a heavy burden for a mother to leave you with and then to lose her. And so I was taking that quite literally. And really racked with guilt. And Bishop Gene felt that. He sensed that. And I won't give it all away, because I want people to put this puzzle together the way I did as they read the book. Mm-hmm. But eventually he got to a place where he made me define what it was I might be saving.
Yeah.
What was her life? And I thought, her life was about being courageous and curious, never accepting someone else's opinion that something is impossible, but also being curious enough to find compassion, that those braces and those crutches on her legs, those great limitations that should have immobilized her forever, actually made her fly. It meant she was the first to be able to leave home to go to university. She moved to California. When they said you couldn't have kids, she said, forget about that. She had three, even though she liked to remind me she died for a moment having me.
Yeah.
But it was also about that curiosity, because she wished, I think in her heart, that people approached her with less fear because of the way she looked, because of the way she walked, because of her difference, that she was courageous enough to show curiosity about others. And that sometimes might seem unexpected from someone who is so conservative. That was the great dichotomy. My mom was filled with dichotomy. And so my mother's life was about reaching out, was about trying to bridge divides, was about curiosity. And I have to say, if that's her life, it's a life that we need right now. And it's a lesson we need right now, which is no matter where you land in the political divide, there is a higher plane than politics, people. And my mom saw it. That's why I told this story. I hope it's a story that can help other families. I hope it's a story that can help other communities. And I hope, like a pebble in a pond, maybe my great dream is that in some small way here and there could help this country. That's my mother's life. That's why I wrote this book.
Dustin Lance Black, whose new memoir is called Mama's Boy, A Story from Our Americas. Black is coming to Salt Lake City this week. On Thursday night, he's going to be a guest of Equality Utah, their Q-Talk series. He's speaking at that. You can get details about that because there are just a few tickets left on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The show is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.